Welcome to Art Bell's Somewhere in Time, tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from May 11th, 1999.
From the high desert and the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening or good morning, as the case may be, across all these many time zones stretching from in the west, the Hawaiian and Tahitian island chains, exotic if you can picture the hammock and the drink with the little umbrella and the Hawaiian dancing girls and... Well, you get the picture. Eastward to about the same picture in the Caribbean, the U.S. Virgin Islands, south into South America, north all the way to the poles, and worldwide on the Internet. This is Coast to Coast AM, and I'm Art Bell. And I'm going to take a night off from the video cameras tonight, so we're not going to run video. I'll tell you why. Because I woke up 8 minutes from airtime. This has never, ever happened to me in my life before, and because of my somewhat altered, slightly altered schedule, I slept in. For some reason, the alarm didn't go off, and I just kept right on sleeping, and so there you have it. I see our ambassador has left his battered embassy on Wednesday morning. In Beijing, as you know, the Chinese were surrounding it and pelting it with rocks and whatever they could get their hands on. And I guess China finally decided that they were going to play the apology that we finally got aired in China. We were making that apology for some time. I'm still trying to figure out how... Now, let's see. Outdated maps. A nation that builds cruise missiles... that can go down the chimney of the assigned location. In fact, sent whatever it was we sent down the chimney of an assigned location. Just a term I'm using, or through the window of the assigned location, which happened to be the Chinese embassy. The very last place that anybody would want to hit in Belgrade, the Chinese embassy. I'm still trying to figure out how we did it. Now... there, you can make certain observations and ask yourself certain questions. One, did we know what we were hitting? I think so. Two, why would we hit it? Well, I've kind of toyed with the idea that the Chinese might have been passing some intel... to the Serbs about how to take down our airplanes, what to shoot at, how to see the unseeable. And by the way, I understand now, they're telling me that our supposed F-117 unseeable aircraft are quite seeable with the old-fashioned long-wave radar. Just a random thought. So we continue to bomb, and the war continues to go on. The White House website was taken offline by hackers, reportedly angered by the NATO bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, Yugoslavia. Ooh. Were they really? Really, it says here. The Associated Press is saying that the White House was taken offline as hackers broke in. NBC News, by the way, reporting those hackers were in Hong Kong. Why am I laughing? You may recall the April 1st little thing that we did. As you know, I very much oppose this war, and we sort of hacked up a hacked site of our own. Ailments linked to an aging population, that would be us. Habits like smoking, as I do, are going to place added strain on developing countries even as they struggle against AIDS, according to the WHO. Non-communicable diseases like the world's first three killers, heart disease, strokes, respiratory infections, are expected to account for almost 75% of the world's illness by the year 2020. up 43% from last year, according to the agency's annual World Health Report. The study also found that AIDS has now displaced TB as the world's deadliest infectious disease. I'll tell you something else that can kill you. That's waking up and looking at the clock and finding out you're on the air in 5 minutes. Oh, heart attack time. All right, to the phones we go. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Good morning.
Oh, I'm sorry, that's the wrong number.
Oh, no problem. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Is this Art Bell's show?
It is indeed.
Is this Art Bell?
I'd be the only one here. Now, turn your radio off, please.
It's off, Art. A couple days ago, they did a replay of another show. And that particular show, they were mentioning about Nostradamus in September, the month of September coming
yes,
up?
Yes, yes.
And
actually, Nostradamus' quatrain, the one you're speaking
correct.
Of, could occur in July, or it could occur in September. There's quite a bit of controversy about that, but it would seem it's one or the other.
Okay. Maybe I can give you a little bit of enlightenment on it. It's a precursor to the great chastisement God speaks about in Revelation.
Now, how do you know that?
Because we have been in a prophecy group for the last 3 years receiving messages.
I see, but if that was so, excuse me, sir.
Okay.
But if that was true, just out of curiosity, why would Nostradamus have not told us of this immense event, since he was probably the greatest predictor of events in the world?
Good question. I don't know. You'd have to ask him in the later life.
I mean, I'm not knocking your prophecy group, you understand,
that.
But I'm, you know.
I don't know. I can only tell you what we've been told to spread the message of. It's going to happen in Fort Worth and Trinity Park. We've been having it for the last 2 years.
What's going to happen?
This is the third year.
What's going to happen in Fort Worth?
It's September 14th is the Feast of the Holy Cross.
And so what's going to happen in Trinity Park in Fort Worth?
God has told us that he will perform miracles and he will give a great grace and enlightenment for those that are there to pass through untouched through the great chastisement.
You mean people that are in Trinity Park are going to be cool and everybody else is going down the drain?
I'm not going to say that. No, he
well,
didn't
I'm,
say
I'm
that.
I'm trying to interpret what you're saying here.
I know.
You said, in essence, that Trinity Park is a sort of a safe little area there in Fort Worth.
We don't know when the great chastisement's coming. He's not said that.
Well, you could be waiting around in Trinity Park for a long time.
Well, we're not going to
need food and camping.
It's just a precursor to the great chastisement. Great chastisement could last a month, 2 months.
Even
years.
I'm not fully awakened. I can say great chastisement, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Another term for it is a tribulation.
All right. I understand. All right. The part I don't get is how Nostradamus, who predicted everything, or did not everything, but certainly was a great predictor, a great seer of his time, and perhaps some would say the greatest seer of all time, would have missed the Trinity Park thing. I can see people down there waiting in Trinity Park now, camping day and night, because he said you wouldn't know the date, so you just sort of be there until you ran out of food. Wildcard line, you're on the air. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Art Bell?
Good guess. How are you?
This is your friend from Looning.
From where?
Looning, Nevada.
Okay, welcome.
Dee?
Yes, Dee?
Yeah, I've been writing you.
Okay.
How are you tonight?
Barely awake, Dee. What's on your
mind? Poor baby, I'm glad you're back home.
Yes.
We missed you, hon.
Well, here I am.
I just said I'd call and let you know I'm out here.
Oh, I see. So you have nothing special to say.
Well, we've been having contrails out here, a lot of them.
Oh, we have them here, too.
Uh-huh.
The question is, are they of the dark variety? I mean literally somewhat darker than regular contrails. Do they spread and turn into kind of a mist, and then do they make you sick?
Yes. There's some people that have been sick out here.
I'm still not sure what to say about all of that. The evidence appears overwhelming. Thank you for the call. That something is going on beyond normal contrails. I know. You hear about that. Contrails making people sick, and unless you sit down and you listen to the itemized evidence, you could easily turn your nose up and say some sort of four-letter word and walk away, and I would understand that, but once you have heard the evidence, it's not quite so simple. First-time caller line, you would have been on the air. East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning, Art.
Hi.
It's Christian from Western New York.
Hello there.
There's something I heard on the Canadian radio I thought I would bring to your attention.
CBC?
Well, it's the French radio of Toronto.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Get it from across the lake here.
Oh, I see.
I used to live in Quebec, so I listened to that.
I see.
They were informing us that the Canadian government fessed up giving 900 soldiers vaccination before they went to Somalia for
Somalia?
Malaria.
Somalia for malaria?
Yeah.
Well, so?
And they were unapproved vaccines.
Oh. Yeah, I had to take malaria medicine myself. I went to South Africa, and I had to take that damn stuff, I think, for 8 weeks.
Hmm. Well, what was funny about it is that they didn't warn the soldiers before they gave them. And it was pretty important because...
yeah, there's a lot of that going on, sir. Thank you. A lot of it going on. Now, if there was not enough notice for the soldiers who are leaving for Somalia, I can understand they might try something new. Because even the relatively newest treatments right now for malaria have got to start, a week or two in advance if you're going to an area where there is malaria. And then they continue for about the next 8 weeks, if my recollection serves properly, 6 to 8 weeks, somewhere in there. And modern treatment's a little better. You take one pill a week, but I'll tell you, that little guy will throw you for a loop. So if they were sending soldiers in cold, they might try something like that. International line, you're on the air. Hi.
Hey, Art, how you doing?
It's okay.
It's Ben Fawning. I'm in Canada.
Yes, sir.
Detroit and Toronto.
Yes, sir.
A little food for thought for you.
Sure.
Remember a while back that Area 51 caller that's falling? He sounded like he was freaking out. You only talked to him for maybe like a half a minute.
That was a long time ago, sir.
Remember what he said? He said, Art, he said they're going to get rid of the major population so that the population is easier to control.
I remember every detail of it.
Isn't it funny now that the contrails are coming out and people are getting sick? Interesting, isn't it?
Yes, it is, sir. I hadn't thought of the connection, but...
I just thought of it the other day, and I thought I got to tell Art.
Okay, well, that's...
My line's in and out, Art, and I'll just sit back and listen to you talk.
All right, take care. It's as good a shot as anybody. He refers to what we loosely call the Area 51 caller, who was screaming and crying when our satellite, the satellite we're on here, lost Earthlock. An event that has occurred since, but not prior, certainly never to my radio program. And I went in and I looked at the lights on my uplink, and they were all dark. They were all dark, and I thought, obviously, our uplink had failed. But what I never thought of was, those lights don't come on if there is no satellite where you're pointed. So it was, I looked for smoke. I couldn't see any smoke curling up behind the thing. But I thought it had failed. And it did so at one of the wildest moments on this program or in this program's history. I mean, here was this guy crying and screaming and telling me that he knew that our government was in the process of concocting some terrible thing that was going to wipe out a large segment of the population. And that's when we went off the air. Later to be told that our satellite had lost Earth lock. Yeah, right. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Art. This is Matthew from Everett, Washington.
Hello.
To Como 1000.
Yes, sir.
I just had a quick question for you.
Sure, fire away.
About your time machine.
Oh, yes.
Yes, I was wondering where I might be able to get a phone number or maybe a web address or something to get more information on maybe buying one or something.
Well, I had a gentleman on the air as a guest who builds these time machines.
I believe I remember that. It was a while ago, I thought.
Try the name Stephen Gibbs.
Stephen Gibbs.
Does that sound familiar to you?
Actually, yes, it does. I don't remember. I was trying to look on your website, trying to look up time machine, anything else, anything I could find on it, but...
Actually, there should be a picture up there somewhere of my time machine.
Oh, really?
Yes. And so, have you tried going... You say you've tried going to the website. What I suggest is there's a search engine within the website itself, and you should be able to enter the words time machine, and it should give you the photograph at the very least.
Ooh, I believe I tried that, and nothing came up, but I didn't try Stephen Gibbs, so I might want to give that a shot then.
Steve Gibbs or Stephen Gibbs, enter any of that and see what you can get. In the meantime, I will consult with my webmaster and see if he's got that. I still have my time machine. No, I have not plugged it in. No, I have not yet tried it. One day I may get up the guts to do it, but that day has not yet arrived.
All right, I was just interested. Well, thank you.
All right, thank you, and good luck. I'll check with Keith on that. I have the machine. It has this incredibly giant electromagnet that plugs into 110 volts. And I'll tell you how close I've been. I've had it all hooked up, ready to plug the plug in the wall. There's always something that stops me, and maybe it's common sense.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from May 11th, 1999.
Up through tarmac to the sun again, or to fly to the sun without burning a wing, to lie in a meadow and hear the grass sing. And all these things in our memories haunt, and they use them to help. Take this pain on this strength, just for me. Ride, take me right to the
Bell, Somewhere in Time, tonight, featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from May 11th, 1999.
Coming at the top of the hour is James McMullen. James has been tracking Bigfoot, yes, Bigfoot, for years and years now. He should be a very, very interesting interview. He's down in Florida, and he's tracked Bigfoot mainly, I guess, in the Florida area. No doubt other areas as well, and Bigfoot is one of my favorite topics, so that's what we're going to do at the top of the hour. By the way, I have a Washington Post story here that caught my attention, should catch yours, and I'm sure you heard. After an unexpected detour, it says, to Beijing, Russian peace envoy Viktor Chernomyrdin returned to Moscow last night and aligned himself rhetorically with China's angry demand for an unconditional halt in NATO's bombing campaign. Now, where was it that I heard about China and Russia aligning before some kind of big event? I just know there's something there, and I can't quite grasp it. A little worrisome, huh? East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hey, Mr. Bell, a question from New York City, Curtis Lewa.
All right. Oh, is this actually Curtis asking or Curtis?
No, this is Tommy.
So it's Curtis's guy, Tommy, asking.
That's right.
All right.
Tommy. Ready?
Well, yeah, so I suppose.
He wants to know why you take off all the time without telling anyone, and how come you get to keep the hour?
Well, if Curtis had only been listening, he would know that I said last week on the air when I came on that I was going to take a few extra days off because of family things and that we're going to try out some other hosts in that slot. For example, coming this Friday and then again Monday is Whitley Strieber, who's going to sit in.
Okay, one more.
Mm.
How long do you think before Curtis gets back the hour?
Well, I don't know. Ask Curtis when he thinks hell is going to freeze over and do the wild thing at 775-727-1295. Okay, Andy, just had to bleep you out. Yes, we don't allow. Andy, I thought you knew that we didn't allow names on.
We don't
allow last names on the air, so never give me your last name.
Okay.
All right, Andy, what's on your mind?
I got a couple of questions for you.
I'll take one.
Okay, have you heard from Madman Markham yet?
Madman Markham, no. The answer is a clear no. Madman Markham is a man who constructed a time machine. First, a small-scale model, which he threw a little bolt through. When he threw the bolt through it, it disappeared. It disappeared. Gone. Then he appropriated some transformers from the local electric company, something that got him put in the pokey for a period of time, and was about to push the button, walk through this giant machine he had made on his back porch. Well, he spent a little time paying his debt to society for taking those transformers. Then he got out of jail and was going to build a gigantic time machine and had a big warehouse, and I think did, and was supposed to notify me. But did he? No. Has he walked through the machine? Possibly. So there may be a warehouse somewhere outside of Kansas City with a big machine and nothing but a little pile of dust on the floor, which could be Madman. I called him Madman Markham affectionately. Or Madman could be who knows when. First time caller line, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Art. This is Stuart in Topeka, Kansas.
Hello, Stuart.
And I'm listening to you on KMAJ 1440.
Yes, sir.
I also listened to you the other night talking to Bonnie on 3830. You were the strongest station out there.
Just puts out a little bit.
And you were talking to Tired Old Man.
Yeah, after we did the show with Bonnie, a lot of people won't know, I said, let's go up to 3830, and Bonnie said, sure. So up we went.
And I listened to you on a CNGN radio, and they are the best.
Oh, they're incredible.
That CC radio does have to be incredible. Unfortunately, they won't let us carry it.
Well, the difference, of course, between the CC and the Sanjin, say the ATS-909 or any of the other series, is that they get shortwave. Now, the CC doesn't.
Right.
The CC gets the best AM reception in the world. The Sanjin, nothing matches that for shortwave.
I have a reception report all made out. Will you QSL with me?
Yes, I will.
Okay, I'll send it out in the morning. I also have you on tape. You want a copy of that?
I'd love it, yes.
Okay.
All right, send it along. And
there's a lot of people listening to you here in Topeka, including several people from Radio Shack.
Really?
Yes, you're very, very popular.
Well, I appreciate the call, sir. Thank you, and send me a card, and I will QSL. That means I have these cards made up. As a matter of fact, I took the picture that Ramona took of me on my 50th birthday, and I put it on a QSL card. That would be a confirmation of reception. It's something hams send out to other hams or shortwave listeners when they're heard, and it's just a little card showing my station and me. And, sure, I'll send it along. A wild card line, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi, Art.
Hello.
Yeah, this is Paul from Planet Earth. How are you tonight?
Well, I'm okay, Paul. Good to have an Earthling.
Yeah. Hey, I was wondering if anybody else heard what Bill Cosby said on the Today Show to Al Roper.
What did he say?
Well, we...
West of the Rockies, call toll-free 1-800-618-8255.
And I was just so shocked, and nothing ever came out, nothing was ever said about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you'll have to excuse me, but I wouldn't think for one second that Bill Cosby would say such a thing. I took it out. Because I don't believe for a second that he would say that. And I'm not going to repeat, obviously, what was said. But I don't believe it. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi.
Yeah, hi, Art. This is Paul from Green Bay.
Hello, Paul.
How you doing tonight?
Fine. What's on your mind?
Well, you remember the tornado we had recently in Oklahoma City?
Actually, there were a couple of dozen of them, yes.
It's terrible, right?
Yes.
Would you be interested in possibly knowing when the next one's going to come along?
Yes, I would. And I'd also be interested in knowing how you know. Oh, you have your radio on, don't you?
No, sir. I'm in a truck stop.
You're at a truck stop. Okay. That's what I'm hearing in the background then. All right. When is the next one coming, and how do you know?
Well, within the next 3 to 6 days, I can't tell you exactly where it is because I'm forbidden to do that.
By whom?
The Maker.
The Maker. So, you mean God?
Yes, sir.
God. God told you there's going to be another tornado.
No, this is, I chose the place.
You chose the place.
Yes, sir.
So you are acting then as God's agent.
It was for a service, yes, sir.
It was what?
It was a reward for a service.
You did a service for God.
Yes, sir.
And God, in turn, is going to allow you to actually create a tornado.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Where?
The place is where the new Caesar resides.
The new New York City?
Where the new Caesar resides. It shouldn't be too hard to figure out if you really think about it.
The new Caesar. Well, the new Caesar, some people would say, I don't know, they say it's a lot of people. Our president, it could be...
you said it.
I did?
Yes, you said it.
Yeah, okay. Well, there you are then. So Washington, D.C. then.
You said it, sir. Peace be with you.
Yeah, peace be with you, too, O servant of God. The only part of all that I don't understand is why God, as a favor, or whatever, would allow anybody to do anything awful. You see, what I think I would suggest to you, sir, is that you may not be dealing with the entity that you think you're dealing with. I wonder if that's occurred to you. That, in fact, the one you may be dealing with, the one who would make deals like that, may not be, you know, who you think it is. Just a random thought, something for you to kick around. Not many tornadoes in Washington, D.C. First-time caller line, you're on the air. Hi.
Hey, Art. I was wondering, I got a question about a guest or two.
All right.
Do you think it hurts the show when you have Ed Dames on
after he makes predictions or remote viewing the spores coming to Africa that never materialized or the nuclear.
You know, I've really got some bad news for you, sir.
Mm-hmm.
There was a story, Associated Press, just the other day that indicated a new fungus that had previously killed up to one-third of all the crops in Africa.
Right. Was that the spore attack?
Was back again, only it was a modified spore now. Do you know, you hadn't heard that?
No, I heard that maybe a week or two ago, but what about the kill shot that happened in April that was supposed to get us all?
Well, if you listen carefully to Ed Dames, he said the timeline of the kill shot, or of the precursor, actually, to the kill shot could not be precisely nailed down.
Did he say that when he made the prediction?
He said that before. Said that before April arrived.
Well, what about the North Korean nuclear attack that never happened?
Well, that one still lies in the future. But if you've been watching carefully the news about North Korea, they're making all kinds of news about war.
No, he was saying this the last time that North Korea was in the news, maybe at least a year ago at least.
If you look at the releases from the North Korean news agency on a daily basis now, you will see them talking about war.
So you think Ed Dames makes a reliable remote viewing prediction?
Well, that, sir, I leave up to you.
Okay.
Okay. Take care. Wildcard Line, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning, Art. This is Raymond from Michigan.
Hello, Raymond.
I have a question about remote viewing.
Sure.
I don't really understand it, but have any of your guests... first of all, are they able to remote view the past?
Yes.
Okay, and have any of them ever told you whether they remote viewed what happened in Roswell?
I do believe that Ed remote viewed the Roswell event, and I don't want to put words in his mouth and recall for you incorrectly what he said right now, but yes, he did remote view Roswell, and I'm sorry I don't recall exactly what he said. In remote viewing, there is, in essence, no time. There are only events. Ed would explain it that way, and that you can target an event as you would a sort of a spike coming up out of the noise.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter whether that event is now, in the past, or the future. So I'm sorry, I can't recall for you what he said about Roswell, but he did something on that.
Perhaps it's on his website, maybe.
That's a good shot.
I thought maybe I'd tell you something else you might find interesting, too. One night while I had your show on, I scanned the entire AM band from top to bottom, and I picked up your show on 16 different stations.
Really?
Yeah, it came in pretty well here, 16 different
stations. One night we should have a contest, and we should see how many people running a recorder so they could prove their claim could go from the bottom of the dial to the top of the dial and see what the maximum number of stations at any given... I would think somebody, for example, in the Midwest would have the best shot at it because they'd be getting Midwest, East, and West Coast stations.
Yeah, I get it pretty well from New York to Cleveland to Milwaukee and other stations that I don't even know where they are.
Well, one night we'll have a contest and we'll have people send in tapes of their proof. How would that be? East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi. He didn't push the button. Now, East of the Rockies, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hello?
Hello.
I was thinking about this, Art. You know, we got a situation now, it seemed like it's a big grab for money. You go to a grocery store and their prices are going sky high. Everywhere you look, it seemed like they just eat you alive. I don't know what's going on about our financial situation in this country.
Well, I'll tell you, where have you been? I mean, back in the 70s, when Jimmy Carter was in office, then we had inflation. Now, we have almost no inflation.
Huh. I was wondering how good our money is. They say it's worth 8 cents a dollar.
Well, I don't know. If you spend a dollar on any given product, do you feel like you get a dollar's worth in return?
No.
No? Give me an example.
Okay. I go to a store, and they have a little card, card there, and... costs $1.69 if you don't have that card. So they run that card through the computer and they sell it to you for 99 cents.
You mean like if you're a member of their little club?
They're right.
Yeah, okay. A lot of stores have that.
And I'm really disturbed about prices getting so far out of sight. people on Social Security like me,
mm-hmm.
another 6 months, how in the world are we going to survive on a little what little we get?
Well, again, I would say to you, now it may well be that I'm out of the loop here, but I don't think so. Inflation rates right now are at all-time lows, just about at all-time lows. I can remember when we had about a 21% inflation rate for a while. Now that
I remember
was,
that.
Oh, you do? You
well,
remember,
yes, I,
you remember
I'm 64.
That? Oh, okay. Well, then, sure, of course you remember that. Now that was inflation compared to what we've got today. Today, in fact, inflation is so damn low that if you have money in the bank, you can't get interest rates worth a damn thing.
That's true. It just seems like I was wondering what the relationship with, you know, with our economy right now is with 2000. I heard this said to me that 100 American dollars is worth one European dollar.
Nah.
I wouldn't know.
That's not true.
You don't believe that,
even, even the brand-new European euro-dollar, the exchange rate I can't give you off the top of my head, but it's, believe me, much more generous than that.
Uh-huh. Well, I was just curious about it. And
now, I'll tell you this, sir, and I've got to go because we're about out of time, but if you travel to Europe or you travel to Asia, and you convert your dollars, and then you begin to spend them, you will realize how very a little your money means, because the dollar hardly goes anywhere. In fact, it's scary. Went to Tokyo, got two Cokes and a beer, and it was about $40. Can you imagine that?
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight, featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from May 11th, 1999. Presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired May 11, 1999.
Good music, bumper music for the subject coming up. We're going to talk about Bigfoot. James McMullen is about to join us. And for about 23 years, James has been a full-time author, naturalist, and independent tracker of the endangered Florida panther in the swamplands. As an environmental education teacher and wildlife lecturer on the panther and the Everglades, he taught thousands of students state and nationwide. As a matter of fact, he's got a New York Times bestseller, Cry of the Panther, Quest of a Species. Now, check this, going into its fourth printing. It's an account of his intense tracking experience in the Glades with the endangered big cat. For all those years of tracking the panther, I also have had, he says, unexplained encounters with physical evidence and unaccountable strange sightings of an unknown creature known as Bigfoot. So, we're going to talk to somebody who, you know, there's a bunch of Bigfoot hunters out there and Bigfoot enthusiasts, but here's a man who has tracked wildlife for all his adult life virtually and claims to have encountered evidence of what we know or we have been told is. We'll talk about what Bigfoot actually may be, what Bigfoot really is and what Bigfoot is not, whether Bigfoot is actually a living today as sort of a throwback to something from our very ancient times, indeed prior to the time when man walked on Earth, or is Bigfoot some sort of genetic mutation, or is Bigfoot some sort of dimensional breakthrough? All of these theories and many more have been forwarded. We'll find out what James McMullen thinks Bigfoot is coming up shortly. Well, all right, coming up now, James McMullen. And for most of his adult life, the last 23 years, he's been tracking animals in Florida. And he did have one extremely unusual encounter that he's going to tell us about. But right now, here is Jim. Jim, welcome.
Yes, happy to be here. And I'd like to thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Well, you're welcome. You're very welcome. Why have you been tracking animals in the Everglades for 23 years?
Well, if we just talk about the Everglades, when I came down here in 1976, immediately I was intrigued with the endangered species Florida panther. And having had a great deal of training before that, being in the United States Marine Corps, being in Vietnam, and having a father and grandfather that were both woodsmen and fishermen, obviously I was drawn to the tree line to begin with.
Sure.
So I come to the Everglades and immediately was interested in the endangered Florida panther. In those days, way back in 1976, nobody believed that there were any panthers left in the Everglades. So I quite literally set out to put together my trekking skills that I have learned over the years and step into the swamps of the Everglades, specifically in the beginning, to prove that they were out there. And that's what's been going on for 23 years.
Did you do that?
Yes, I did.
In what way did you prove it? Did you take photographs?
Well,
did you capture one or what?
No, I have what we term a naturalistic philosophy. And quite simply what that means is that I will track the animal, I will gather information on his critical habitat and his behavior,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to study him out in natural habitats. I don't want to catch him and put him in a cage and maybe end up ruining him for life. But the trick there is that after learning all those different experiences with the cat over the years, I have shared it with the students and the general public through environmental education and public awareness. And I feel that that is one of the strong fibers, in fact, of saving the cat from the very beginning. And having worked at a nature center, I incorporated my tracking of the panther into the nature center work and in farm education.
All right. Well, I'm don't call me Noah, but there would have to be more than just one if they are to continue. There would have to be quite a few, right?
Well, what I found really extremely exciting was that I found my first cat. It took me about 8 months. I did find tracks, and then I had a beautiful and wonderful sighting of the cat downrange in the Big Cypress swampland. And out of that, I realized, well, if there's this one healthy cat out there, there must be more. Over the years, tracking not only in the Everglades but other key areas in the state of Florida, I have found, verified with physical evidence, 64 cats, male and female.
Oh, my. All right. Well, the obvious question is, James, how could you find what others apparently declared to be extinct?
Well, it was, the line was, well, the Florida panther is almost extinct. So what I did was I went to the folks that lived out in the swamp, and I went to the Native Americans, and I asked them, that would be the Seminole and the Miccosukees down here, and I told them my background and what I was doing, and I learned inside of 3 weeks that there were Florida panther in the Everglades from the old-timers. They didn't give me specific locations because they saw kind of like a twinkle in my eye, but I found some swampies out there that were very much aware that there were still Florida panther roaming the Everglades, you know, free of man. So it was, in the face of it, he was almost extinct. He was already on the endangered species list, and it was extremely difficult, in fact, to find a Florida panther. But they were out there. It had to be proven with physical evidence, and that's what I set out to do.
A twinkle in your eye?
Well, I say that because I went down to a real small village down here in the Everglades called Everglades City. I walked into one of the old grocery stores, and there was an elderly gentleman sitting there, and he was just like you would think you would see in a movie, and he was sitting there having a cup of coffee, and I boldly walked up to him, didn't know him from Adam, and I says, you look like a person that might know if there's still Florida panther in Everglades. And he kind of looked at me, and he kind of gave me this chuckle, you know, and he says, well, hell, he says, I saw one more than 3 weeks ago up in Alligator Alley, you know, like that. That set me in the direction of starting to track my first cat.
Well, let me give you a little parallel. I don't know if it's the same thing or not, but I live in a little town of Pahrump, Nevada, near Death Valley. And a lot of people try and find where I live for whatever reason. The people here in Pahrump, in my little town, tend to protect me. And since maybe I'm like an endangered species or something, I don't know. But people will not tell reporters and people where I live. It's just a nice thing that they do for me here in Pahrump.
Oh.
And we're a town of about 30,000 now. And I wonder if there's a parallel there. In other words, perhaps there are many people who knew the panther still existed, but because they didn't want it to pass from existence,
right. They
virtually told stories denying its
existence.
Absolutely. You think that's it?
Absolutely. That is extremely good parallel because I think because of my attitude from the very beginning of saving the cat and informing students of how to save the cat, you know, this sort of thing, prevailed.
So until they were sure that you had no evil intentions.
Oh, well, let me put it this way. I had no evil intentions, but I must tell you, even today, 1999, there is still a negative element out in the Everglades and other key areas of Florida that would like to do harm to the panther, and that's very sad.
Why?
I had one incident where this fellow wanted to be the person to kill the last panther, and he was an old hunter, this type of thing, you know.
Great.
Obviously I'm dead against all of that.
Can you explain the psychology behind somebody who wants to be the person to kill the last of a species on Earth? What kind of person is that, by the way?
You know, I can approach that. I've never really been a hunter my whole life.
Right.
But there's something unique about, as far as the hunter mind goes, there's something unique about getting the last animal and having the pelt hanging on the wall or having the tail and ears. The claws of the Florida panther, the last one, and he feels then he's extremely important because he got the last one.
You know. Let me show you how opposite I view it. Somebody like that to me is evil incarnate. In other words, to kill the last of a species is so evil, such a great sin, that I would expect that when I went up to the pearly gates to be immediately rejected and put on the down elevator.
Absolutely.
That's how seriously I would view that. And so I can't even get into anybody's head who would. But I'll tell you, it takes all kinds, I guess, to make up the world, huh?
Well, I attempted to do that once, and I tried to write an article for a wildlife magazine down here in Florida on just what we're talking here, and I'll be completely honest with you, I couldn't do it, and I turned down the assignment. Wasn't much money involved. That wasn't the point. I just couldn't do it. I did not want to get into his mind. And to make it an effective story, article.
I mean, that's almost like trying to get inside the mind, wrap your mind around the concept of a serial killer.
Yes, yes. I'm known down here in Florida as an extreme conservationist. And it goes something like this. People either love me or hate me. Mm-hmm. So in between there.
Not a favorite of the hunters, I'm sure.
No, I'm not. Although I must tell you, I have only two times, but I did talk to two hunters that did hang up their weapons and picked up a camera instead and started taking photographs of deer and bear and wild hog, you know, this sort of thing, because of the effect of my book, Cry the Panther, when they read it. Something clicked, and they just could not go out there and kill animals anymore, and I was really very excited about something like that. I wish it was more widespread, but obviously it's not.
Jim, when I was 13 years old, my dad gave me my first 22. I had had BB guns prior to that. And one day, from my third... I was way up on the third floor where I had a Radio Shack. I opened the window, and I took my .22, and I shot a squirrel. And I ran out into the yard, and here was this squirrel dying. And I tell you, Jim, to this very day, and I'll soon be 54 years old, it still weighs on my psyche, on my consciousness, so much that I could almost go back to tears. And that's how much I care about life. It was the stupidest, dumbest thing I ever did in my whole life, something I guess a 13-year-old might do. But I immediately, I mean, I sat down there in the yard and I cried, and I have never killed a living thing since.
Fantastic.
That's just the way
that's
it is.
That's a fantastic story.
That's a true story.
Yeah.
And so...
I must tell you, I don't mean to interrupt you, but there is a parallel working here, and as we get more into the Bigfoot phenomena, and it's haunting. I mean, it's what's going on here. Since Bigfoot has been in the news here the last couple of years because of the latest sightings, there is a negative element out there.
Mm-hmm.
Get this one. That is... physically, consciously, and on weekends out there trying to find a Bigfoot to kill him.
I know.
Or her.
I know.
To prove they exist.
Well, there is a...
can you believe that?
Yes, I can. There is
you
a,
know?
There is a credentialed scientist in Washington somewhere, I can't recall which university, who suggests that, in his opinion, there should be one Bigfoot killed. So that we can prove Bigfoot is real, and then, he says, a law should be passed that would then provide for the death penalty for any others that are killed. That's his. That's the way he's handling this.
And he's in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, no, Washington State.
Oh, state of Washington.
Yes. In other words, and I see his point of view.
Yeah.
You kill one, you prove there really is such a thing, then you get officially put on the endangered species list, you get to study it, so forth and so on, and you have a giant penalty for killing any others. I take it you wouldn't agree with that.
No, I don't. And again, it's because of my personality makeup and holding steadfast to a naturalistic philosophy. In my opinion, a skilled tracker over a period of years can develop an immense amount of physical evidence, whether it be moderate or strong, to the point where, you know, we're talking about Bigfoot here, to the point where you may never have to capture one, you may never have to hunt one down and kill it to prove that it exists. However, if someone did find one that recently died, then that would be the evidence beyond a shadow of a doubt, or skeletal remains. You know, and it's we can, as we get into this thing, you'll see some very basic skills that are used to develop that criteria. And that's one of the things that I am super concentrating on right now, looking for skeletal remains. And I have quite a story to tell you about a Bigfoot skeleton.
Can I tell you one?
Sure.
All right. It was about 4 years ago on this program, Jim, and a fellow called in. I interviewed him for, actually twice, and for no less than about 8 hours total. And he had an encounter, Jim, in Missouri with a male and female, which he claimed he killed. I repeat, he killed. He was out hunting with a bunch of friends.
He killed them both?
Yep, killed them both. And when he got a good close-up look at them, he realized that their look was so close to human, to a human appearance, but with all the hair and all the rest of the way we've seen Bigfoot in the Patterson film. He was so scared that he buried them.
No.
Now, I had this man talked into leading us to the spot where he had buried them. But by the time the program was over, we had callers who would call in. And they said he's liable to be charged with murder. And he finally got so freaked out that he refused to talk any more about it. He closed down completely, and I guess I can understand that.
Well, I'll tell you something interesting about that. My father was a lawyer for 60 years, and I got with a lawyer down here, and I asked him about a dead Bigfoot after he got done chuckling a little bit. He realized that I was the one that came forward on the Florida Panther and then also the Bigfoot phenomena down here.
Right.
And I asked him about that. I said, what if one of these crazy guys out there shoots one and kills one?
Exactly.
Is it considered to be murder? He says, there is no way that that can happen because it's an unknown species. There's no DNA to prove what sort of species it is to begin with. Mm-hmm. He felt that the first time around, it would be such an exciting thing to bring one in that the guy would probably be honored. And I said, well, I wouldn't honor him for shooting and killing him. My point is, legally speaking, is there a law on the books that could be used? And he said, no, there is no such law that exists that would have any application to a Bigfoot bringing one in. And I thought, I hope that doesn't get on the news because people would be, you know, even more freer with
the attitude.
Well,
it's on the news now, Jim.
Huh?
It's on the news now.
Well, you know, I must tell you something, Art. In relation to my experiences with Bigfoot down here.
All right, wait. Jim, hold on. We're at a break point. We will break. That's a good natural break anyway. We'll be right back. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight, featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from May 11th, 1999. Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from May 11th, 1999.
James McMullen is a tracker. James McMullen tracked the Florida panther, an animal said not to be on the earth anymore. But he found not one, but 60-some-odd Florida panthers. So he's a natural when you're talking about Bigfoot. And that is what we're talking about right now, or in a moment. Bigfoot, that creature that comes from... Well, I don't know. We'll ask. James will be right back. All right, back now to my guest and Bigfoot. We've got a lot to talk about with regard to Bigfoot. You're talking to somebody who is a professional tracker and has been tracking for 23 years in Florida. And guess what he met up with? James, welcome back. Where were
we? Good question. I was about to say, well, let me just preempt what I was going to say. I think this probably is noteworthy. This is the first time, save for Linda Moulton Powell's interview on a recent sighting down here by someone else out on a ranch, that I'm coming forward with a great deal of information on Bigfoot and the Everglades that has yet ever to be covered.
Never reported.
No. And I must tell you, I have purposely stayed away from the media. I turned down, after my sighting and the sighting flap that's been happening here recently, I turned down 4 newspapers and 2 magazines and 1 television station to come forward on it. I just was not ready at that point.
Why?
Well, I'm a real stickler when it comes to tracking. I want to get as much physical evidence that Bigfoot leaves in the Everglades as I can.
Sure.
Now, obviously, this is ongoing, and it's a question of how far you carry this thing. But I wanted to get more physical evidence over and above the sighting that I had.
Then it would be obvious to ask you why you're coming forward today.
Well, I'll tell you something interesting that's going on, probably not just in the state of Florida, but I know for a fact in the other southern states there have been sightings of Bigfoot, and obviously throughout the world. But something interesting is happening here in Florida. Bigfoot, folks down here call Bigfoot Skunk Ape. I prefer to call him Bigfoot.
Skunk Ape.
People are openly talking about Bigfoot. I have gotten several calls. I have been stopped on the street on several occasions, and people are open, you know, on the street, people are openly talking about the Bigfoot phenomena down here.
Mm-hmm.
This, in my opinion, is an opportunity for public awareness on an unknown species that, in my opinion, if more physical evidence is brought forward, such as DNA and what have you, that there is a possibility he could be put on the endangered species list. Protected at least by Florida state law. So that's kind of where I'm coming from at this point.
Have you compiled enough actual physical evidence to actually do that now?
Well, the ultimate, obviously, is to come in with some super verified DNA, at least to prove unknown species. Now,
yes.
That is becoming, there is a couple people that have come in with hair samples. I had hair samples roughly, that would be 5 months ago, and it did not, we couldn't get any DNA off it, so we just didn't really know what it was. I'm for going to get more plaster casts of tracks. I've got plaster casts of several tracks. I'm looking for scat samples, obviously the hair samples, things like that, to continually build the territory of this particular Bigfoot that I've been tracking here. Staying.
All right, I'm not an expert on samples of footprints or whatever it is that a Bigfoot walks upon, but would that be easily hoaxed? In other words, could you walk around on a piece of wood made up to look like Bigfoot tracks and make tracks that would seem real, or would they be detectable?
No, yeah. I say, in my opinion, if you really get down and study a particular track, there are some obvious telltale signs that a tracker will see in the track that will immediately tell him whether or not it's a fake track fabrication or there really is something to it.
Like what?
Well, obviously the shape of the track to begin with, but more important, if you can find dermal ridges in the heel and hopefully up on the toes itself.
Hmm.
The other thing is not only the shape of the track itself, but if you look very carefully at the track, you can see if Bigfoot was walking on the outer part of his foot or the inner part.
Ah.
Now, if someone were to, I'm with you on the idea of some people have fabricated tracks out in the Pacific Northwest quite well, but even those were detected as being faked. If someone were to take a piece of wood, you know, and carve it out and sand it down, you know, all the things, he wouldn't be able to put the distinguishing characteristics in that footprint that Bigfoot would. And it takes, in my opinion, a great deal of time and experience to be able to detect that.
All right. You had an encounter with a Bigfoot, didn't you?
Yes.
All right. That's the best evidence of all, in my mind, from somebody with your experience. Can you relate that to us as it occurred?
Yes. Quite exciting. After the sighting, I will tell you something interesting. It took me about 3 days to come down from the sighting, the excitement of the whole thing, to calm down. But I'll tell you what happened. I'll kind of describe the first to begin with, number one. I was out consciously tracking and looking for a Bigfoot. And I was using the basic skills that I would track any animal. This was in August, the summer of 1997. And we were having several sightings going on. And the odd thing about that was I did go into that particular area where these sightings were taking place, but I worked on a theory that the possibility that a particular Bigfoot would be looking for high, dry ground, sandy soil.
Mm-hmm.
Down where it was happening, it was during rainy season. There's a very high water line, and I figured that he probably might have gone, or another one,
to higher ground,
another area.
Higher, drier ground.
Yeah, it just seemed reasonable to me, because mammals do that in general.
Okay, after all of these years of looking for the panther, I guess I should have asked you what caused you to begin actively trying to track a Bigfoot, and obviously stories or reports that you got from I don't know where caused you to do that, right?
Yeah, and I'll be honest with you and the listeners. I set out in August of 1997 to discount the sightings, to be honest with you. I thought it was another Bigfoot sighting flap that was going to prove absolutely nothing. And so I set out to try and pick away at it and to prove that those sightings, it was a hoax.
Gotcha.
Quite frankly. And in doing that, I found myself getting deeper and deeper into the possibility with the people that I was talking to that had the sightings. And in fact, they did see something. And so, but at the same time, I was trying to keep as objective as I could. But nonetheless, on this particular day, and it was 2:30 in the afternoon, very bright, and I was in my van, and I drove down into an area, and I went a little bit too far, and I had to turn my van around. Now, this is a very wild place, thick tree line, and I was going down into that area to park the van and then do some tracking. But the van was in such an odd place that I decided to turn it around, and I was backing it up and pushing it forward and backing it up, and finally I got it turned around.
Right.
Now, at this point, I probably should tell you that I did have another witness with me, another person with me.
Oh.
And at present, he is not ready to come forward yet.
Right.
I'm sure that he will in the future, but he was with me, and get this, we had a camera with us. At any rate, I finally got the van turned around.
Well, I've got to stop you again.
Oh, okay.
Why won't he come forward?
Well, to be upfront about that, he did not see Bigfoot. He was with me. He was in the passenger side. He had the camera in his hands. This thing happened. And he did not actually sight Bigfoot there.
Gotcha.
So he feels, to qualify it, that he saw the results of my reaction and everything, and he was going through the experience with me, but he did not sight sight Bigfoot, so he cannot qualify the sighting itself.
Well, in that case, I wouldn't come forward either.
Pardon me?
I wouldn't come forward either, because be doing is testifying to your reaction.
Yeah, oh yeah, he went through the whole thing with me, but he was extremely disappointed that he did not see what I saw.
I understand.
At the time, and so to qualify himself, he says, well, I can't come forward at this time because I did not. You know, I did not see what I did not see Bigfoot. I did not see what you saw. So I thought that was very admirable. You know that.
Yes.
But in the near future, he may. You know, just to verify my reaction and everything, I'm sure that he will in the future come forward on that. For what it's worth.
All right. Anyway, to continue.
So I finally got the van turned around, and it was I was back on high ground, and it was the grass was still high, and we were still slipping a little bit, but I got it up. On the high ground again, and no sooner did I get it up on the high ground, I looked over to the right, 35 feet away, and here was what I thought instantly was a gorilla standing in the tree line. And I said, there he is, there he is. And the person that was with me dropped the camera. And I'm looking, and I don't know whether it was out of panic or what, but my foot hit the gas pedal, and the van surged ahead.
Uh-huh.
And I slammed on the brakes, and I backed it up right on the spot and looked over again of where he was, and he was gone. Now, I'm saying that whole I did end up measuring, went through the whole nomenclature of the sighting and everything. But there he was, standing in the tree line. He was underneath a sable palm frond, the big, wide leaves that people, the palm frond itself. And he wasn't hunched over like a gorilla, but he had the appearance. You know, that was my first instinct. I'm looking at a gorilla. But it wasn't a gorilla. It was a gorilla standing upright, a gorilla-like look, standing upright with two long, thick oak tree legs. And I could see him breathing. I mean, his chest was moving back and forth. He was standing underneath this palm frond where the palm frond shadowed his face. But I could clearly see the dimensions, the height. He was enormous.
There is no question in your mind what you saw.
Oh, no question at all. No question at all.
You have never gone back and thought, well, you know, psychologically, maybe my mind played a trick on me. I was out hunting. I wanted to find this creature. Maybe I saw what I wanted to see. None of that.
Well, no, because there was what I call scanty physical evidence of where he was standing. There were no tracks because he was up on the high ground, but you could see where a very heavy-weighted person, animal, was standing there, and it had pressed down into the grass and pressed down onto that dirt there, okay?
Mm-hmm.
No, I saw him. I know what you're talking about. I have told this story to Linda Howe and a couple other people, anthropologists, and they explored that possibility. And I said, you have to understand that I even critique myself as a tracker for all these years. So it's not something that I would just look off in the tree line and see a shadow and assume that it was an unknown creature like Bigfoot. So I saw what I saw, and I'll stick to it.
Okay. All right, James. What is your best guess about what Bigfoot is? Is this something that has been here for a very long time And is a physical animal just like the panther you found or panthers? Or is Bigfoot some sort of a paranormal creature that comes and goes in ways that mystify us? Or what's your best guess, James?
Well, first of all, I try to grab a hold of as much facts as I can. Bigfoot, let's just deal with the state of Florida for the moment. Bigfoot in the Everglades has always been here. We can go way back to the pioneer times. We can go way back to when Seminole first came down. The Indians, the Native Americans down here talk about him. It's awful hard for someone to sit down with Native Americans and talk to them, but I was able to do that, and they even gave me one of the names that they call him. They call him Esti Jepjaki, and that means tall, hairy man. Mm-hmm. And they look at it with a different point of view. He's physical, but he's spiritual. And he's one of the spirits of the Everglades that is very, very beneficial to the ecosystem there. They have beautiful, beautiful definition of, and they don't call him Bigfoot. Very seldom, if ever, will you hear a Seminole call Bigfoot, Bigfoot. He's always Esti Jepjaki, you know, like that. So
yeah, but what we don't understand is always sort of magic to us. And I suppose before the panther was found, and scientists said there are no more panthers, you could almost put the panther in the same category.
Yes.
You know, sporadic sightings, but nobody ever really put their finger on it, and nobody ever really was able to prove anything. So the panther at that point could have said to be almost the same kind of creature. In other words, half spiritual, half myth, and maybe half real.
Yes. Well, even today he's considered that with the Native Americans. I'm kind of with a naturalistic philosophy because I have seen Florida panther several times in the Everglades, collected physical evidence, and even gotten a couple of pictures of one that obviously, indeed, they're there. And I must tell you, I apply the same criteria to Bigfoot. This is the type of thing. I now carry a video camcorder with me into the Everglades, specifically tracking Bigfoot. So I guess the point I'm making, he's always been here. I've talked to 5th to 6th generation people, folks down here, that their great-grandparents talked about Bigfoot in the Everglades.
All right, an obvious question for you. The most famous of all footage ever taken of a Bigfoot is, of course, the Patterson film.
Yeah.
Very controversial, but boy, it sure does look good. Now, my question to you is, since you've actually seen a Bigfoot,
Yes. And
you've obviously seen the Patterson film a million times,
Yes. Is
that what you saw?
Well, I have to tell you, my Bigfoot had similarities, but it was not as large as on the Patterson film.
Okay.
Plus the fact the coloring of the hair fur on mine was a definite chocolate brownish color.
Okay.
I could even see his skin on his chest, and it was tanned like real dark caramel color. I clearly saw his right hand down alongside, that was hanging down alongside of him there, and the hand, though there was hair, long strands of hair coming down the arm, you could clearly see the fingers.
Wow. Okay, Jim, hold on. We're going to break here at the top of the hour. That's noticing a lot of detail, but then again, a tracker would notice a lot of detail, wouldn't he? James McMullen, who's been tracking in Florida for 23 years, is my guest. He saw Bigfoot. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from May 11th, 1999. listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight, featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from May 11th, 1999.
Exactly what it is. James McMullen, a naturalist, an environmentalist, and a tracker for most of his adult life, is my guest. He saw Bigfoot. We'll get back to him in a moment. If the power should go out, if things should get rough for a while, and by the way, we're going to talk a little bit about the environment as well. I've got a story here that you just absolutely won't believe. It relates to the tornadoes in Oklahoma. They recorded winds in one of these tornadoes at 318 miles per hour. Now, let me tell you about 318 miles per hour. That is at the very top of something called the Fujita scale, which measures tornadoes, and that is 1 mile per hour from what scientists consider to be impossible, an F6. In other words, the scale actually goes all the way to 12, or even through, actually has 13 categories, F0 to F12, making it really technically 13 categories. But this was 1 mile per hour below a theoretically impossible F6. Scientists say you really, in our atmosphere, under any conditions, could never produce an F6, and we got 1 mile per hour from that. So our weather is changing. All right, back now to James McMullen. James, I've got all the material you sent me, and in the material, I've got a beautiful photograph of you pointing to the cast of this incredible foot,
yes,
which looks damn near the size of your upper body. Are these photographs on a website anywhere?
No, they're not. I gave a copy, and I'm going to send a print to Linda Moulton Howell. And there is another website that is being developed down here in Florida that I think inside of a month, and it's going to go on there. And I'm just kind of searching around. You know, I'm more than willing to share, you know, the physical evidence such as the plaster cast.
I mean, this is serious stuff. James, do I have your permission during the next break? I think that I can probably scan these two pages, one with you and the panther and some other things, and the other with the plaster cast. I could actually scan these and get them up on the website.
Oh, sure.
Tonight. You would allow me to?
Oh, absolutely. Sure, sure. That would be very helpful to other trackers in key areas that may be tracking Bigfoot, and, you know, that's right. It might help them out a little bit.
This is very impressive, and so I'm going to do exactly that.
Great.
I'm going to scan like mad, send them to Keith, and see if we can get them
great
up there. All right.
If I may mention one thing
sure,
for your listeners, it may be helpful what we're talking about here, preliminary experiences that I have had with Bigfoot and everything, that it
yes
is being compiled into a manuscript in progress. And all I can say at this point is that yes, the manuscript is in progress. I have two publishers that are interested in the manuscript, but obviously I'm looking for others as well. And it, too, once published, will be on Amazon.com like Cry the Panther is.
So, in other words, you're going to write a book?
Oh, it's in progress, very much so. I've got a very tight outline, and I'm going back to January 1978, when chapter one, when I had a glimpse of something of what I call a swamp dweller. That triggered, you know, I'll tell you the odd thing about this is that in tracking panther,
mm-hmm,
I come on to Bigfoot physical evidence inside of 23 years. The parallel is so intriguing. And I would get on to something on Bigfoot, and I would go off tracking Bigfoot. And I must tell you, I only told two other people over the years until recently about my experience with Bigfoot. One was what I always termed my swamp mentor, a wonderful man that lived in the Everglades. He has since passed away and gone to Forever Island. But he, known him for over 20 years, and I would sit with him under oak trees and talk to him about these things. And you know, when I would have these experiences. And another very dear friend of mine was a half-breed Seminole Indian, and he was nicknamed Gator, and he had seen one as a kid. And so it was easy for me to talk to, you know, those people, those guys, but very hard to come forward because of it needed a long-range, what I term long-range gathering of physical evidence, and always on the outlook that one day I might see one. Inside of 21 years, it happens. So that might be helpful to the listeners a little bit.
It might be. Did this creature make any noise?
Oh, yeah. Well, not at the time I had the sighting, but at other key experiences, yes. And I have labeled them quickly as they had come and gone. I kind of describe them as like savage cries, crawling yowls, and very gentle squeaks. It was quite intriguing, the gentle squeaks. Not something menacing, more like communication, eerie though it sounds. And at one point, I had another person with me that also heard these sounds. So I've got another witness as far as the sounds go.
All right. As long as we're on the subject of sounds, I have one that I want to play for you, James. This is said to be, by Linda Moulton Howe, the authentic sound of a Bigfoot. And I simply would like to play it. This was obtained at night out in the woods. Recorded by some gentlemen who claim this absolutely is the sound of a Bigfoot. Check this one out, folks. That sound is generally agreed to be the sound of a real Bigfoot. Any reaction, James?
Yeah, our sounds were extremely similar to that, and oddly enough, it was in the early evening, but, and what I refer to as long yowls. But our yowls were much more distinct, and it might be because, you know, that was recorded on tape and at a distance. That might
sure.
have something to do with that sound.
Yeah, that was obviously at a distance. You could hear kind of an echoey reverb-type sound to it, so it was at a pretty good distance, and you would imagine it would have that sound at a good distance. So you're
right.
saying something closer could have been quite like that.
Well, ours was closer. Ours was, we calculated that the first sounds we heard were roughly not more than 60 yards away, and the second set of sounds that we heard were probably about a football field away at least. But clearly much sharper, you know, and obviously I didn't have a tape recorder to put the mic out and grab it at that point.
That if I were to hear that sound in the middle of the forest or the middle of the swamp, I think that I'd lose it. I mean, completely.
It goes right through you. I got to tell you. But I'll tell you something else. Because of that sound and the sighting that I had, I specifically set up on a full moon. I night-tracked my guy, my hairy guy, so to speak, for an afternoon and night and into the morning hours till daybreak. I actually night-tracked him.
You found tracks?
No, I night-tracked him.
What does that mean? Explain night-tracking.
Well, basically what I did was I set up a study unit, a tracking unit, where I had sighted him. And I drew a circle roughly a mile and a quarter around that particular area. And then, and this was on the third day, late in the afternoon, I went in at night and set up in camouflage and set also what I refer to as chemical scent with the intention of hopefully drawing him in close enough to where I would get another sighting of him.
Mm-hmm.
And I set up on the ground, camouflage on the ground that time. Most of the time I'm up in a tree, but this time I thought it might be wiser to be on the ground totally camouflaged. And I didn't get a night sighting of him, but I did really feel a wild presence. And anybody that's been out in the woods for any length of time and trackers that do night track know what I'm talking about. You can actually feel the presence of an animal in the area without seeing them. And this was what I call a mega wild presence. He was there.
I recently, James, went to Africa, South Africa.
Did you?
Yes, I did.
Fantastic.
I was about to verify something you just said. In other words, we had with us a South African native, a tracker, and he would sit on the front of the Jeep as we would go through this area. We were way off in, actually about 200 miles north of Johannesburg, a pretty dangerous area in a lot of ways. And the tracker would hear things or see things or sense things, I'm not really sure which, I mean, long before anybody else, the driver of the vehicle or any of us in it, he would just hold his hand up and the vehicle would stop. And sure as hell, in a place where you could never see it or sense it or know it, there would be an animal. Every single time that was true. And it was a tracker's, I don't know what, special hearing, special sense, special what, you would know.
It's what I term, you know, first off, it comes, you know, everybody says it's a sixth sense. And I tend to believe that over the years you actually develop that ability. Like you would develop a muscle, you would develop your senses, your physical senses, but you need, in my opinion, a great deal more than that in tracking animals, or just taking a walk in the swamp. And I go back, I carry it a step further, the sixth sense, I call it swamp sense. And it's, you could call it instinct or what have you, but there are signs out there that animals leave, and you can, and if you look very closely and you listen, you can detect them. And, obviously someone out of the middle of New York, well, I shouldn't say New York, because there's a lot of insects working in New York, but people who are not out in the swampland or in the wilds, they have that sense. You have it. It just needs to be developed and brought out, and then you could go out after a development stage and be able to pick up these and detect these things as well. I think everybody's got it.
Yeah, maybe we do. Does it have something to do with our basic survival instincts? In other words, to know when something is close to you or what?
Yeah. I go back to, I carry it a step further, too. It's also a matter of focus and attitude. The reason why you're out there to begin with. And then the overall canopy on that is obviously for survival purposes. If you're night tracking at night in swampland, where do you not go and where do you stay away from so you won't step on a gator or a poisonous water moccasin, you know, that type of thing. And that's through training, but there's an overall survival instinct, in my opinion, that works there to actually protect you.
And that's something that you can't quite put a finger on. It's just something that develops.
It develops. You can do it consciously to an extent, but then you'll find yourself naturally using it. It's there. It seems to be there when you need it. And what we were mentioning just about when I was talking about a wild presence, you can feel it. You can actually feel it. I can feel it mentally, but also on a physical level. I mean, I'll have chills go down the back of my spine. I'll feel goosebumps come all over my arms. I know something's around. Absolutely 100% certain. If you would wait till the following morning, we would go over into that area like a magnet, and we would find tracks or something to tell us that there was an animal there at that time.
Well, let me tell you something. Men in combat develop the same kind of thing with respect to when they're is an enemy present or when they're about to walk into an ambush. Not every time,
right?
But real combat veterans develop that sense, and it's nothing you can quite put a finger on,
right?
And it's something just a little bit past normal caution. It's coming from a part of their brain that we can't quite discern.
Yeah.
I think a very primitive part of our brain.
I think you're right. I think it's there. Going through Marine Corps training and then going to Vietnam on night patrol or night ambush, you know, it's. I think that's where I got it, to be honest with you. I think that's where it developed and it never left me. So when I came to the Glades and went into the swamp, it was like going home, and it was a very comfortable, pleasant experiences for me, and I've never gotten away from it.
That's amazing. So then, what do you conclude? You sort of said it earlier, or started to say it. What do you really conclude Bigfoot is?
Yeah, I have kind of like what I call a working theory on this, and it's sort of to get a handle on the whole thing. Because of my very peculiar, most of the time bizarre experiences that would occur with the Bigfoot phenomena all the way through these 23 years, and it's, I must tell you, is occurring as I'm tracking now, it is easy for someone to say, oh, well, you saw a primate that has not been discovered and labeled yet. You know, that, to me, that's a cop-out. I think it's much more than that. And you can only draw parallels, you know, they didn't even believe the gorilla existed until the early 1900s. And now, you know, we can take pictures of gorillas and videos of gorillas sitting there eating their vegetation. I think this is a species that is so well adapted. And I'll just deal with, the Everglades. He is so totally adapted to the Everglades. He really has no use for human beings. And here we have an unknown species, a very select species that is very much a part of our ecosystem that has yet to been wholly proven his place in the food chain to begin with. So I can't just simply say, oh, well, it's just a primate. That is not enough for me. I say it is an unknown species, but it is a species that has a great deal of talent and ability hide and stay away from human beings, and that makes for a very intelligent species.
Intelligent species. That's where we'll pick up. Now, I guess I can walk and chew gum, too, because during our conversation in this last 15 minutes, I have scanned the two photographs in question. They are quite remarkable. One of them includes the plaster cast of the Bigfoot foot. You won't believe the size of this damn thing. So, shortly I'll send these to Keith, and we'll get them on the website. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from May 11th, 1999. Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired May 11th, 1999.
You know what turned me on to this song? when I saw the movie Slapshot with Paul Newman. Remember that? They used this song in that movie, and I thought it fit so well. God, that was a funny movie. All right, well, we're talking about Bigfoot this night. If you have questions, we're about to get the lines open for Jim McMullen. Now, I have scanned the two photographs in question and actually sent them off to Keith. How soon they will get there, it's anybody's guess. I would guess in the next 10 or 15 minutes, if we're lucky. And then Keith will reduce them in size for me, because I sent them big. And we'll get them up on the website. We'll tell you all about them. All right. In a moment, we'll get back to my guest and Bigfoot and an environmental question while we're at it, and then we'll go to the phones. Jim McMullen, just around the corner. There is one other candidate for a Bigfoot sound, which I have held on to for a number of years now. I am not quite as convinced by this one, but it certainly is a terrorizing sound. Imagine being in the forest at night and hearing the following. Any comment, James?
Yeah, I'll tell you something interesting. Right off, it sounded like more than one. The reason I'm a little bit intrigued with that sound, I must also tell you that it sounded a little mechanical.
Could have been.
Okay.
I don't know. It could have been.
It seemed to be more than one.
Whatever it was horrendously tortured.
And it sounds very close.
I know, very close indeed. Those are the two Bigfoot sounds I have. I'm having people begging me to play the other one I played, and I'll try and get to it as a program moves forward. But
out of curiosity, where do those sounds come from? I mean, what part of the world?
The first one I played, I'm sorry, I don't recall now. Linda Moulton Howe originally supplied it to me. And this one has been played for various animal experts who... all seemed to uniformly say they thought it was legit.
Hmm.
The first one, not the second one.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm sorry, I don't recall now just exactly where it came from. The minute I heard it, I said, oh, God, Linda, you've got to send that to me right away, and she did. And I've used it throughout the years. So I wish I could answer your question directly, but I can't.
Curious.
All I know is I wouldn't want to hear it.
Yeah.
Now, intelligence, that's what we were talking about toward the bottom, going into the bottom of the hour. To stay away from human beings, to not be tracked, to not be caught,
right.
After all of these years, and people like yourself who are experts at this, this creature would indeed have to be intelligent, wouldn't it? Or we'd have it already.
In my opinion, supremely intelligent. To have evaded any known capture, although you talk about, you know, somebody has elsewhere has ended up shooting one, and I mean, there's no record, there's no physical evidence, but the story comes up. But to have evaded the human species all these years, never captured,
would require intelligence.
Never shot. Now, although there was one sighting where a security guard on the East Coast claimed that he did shoot something that ran off that had to be the general outline of a Bigfoot. That's unverified, though, because there was no physical evidence gathered on it and relying on the sighting. But the security guard was very straightforward, and when you hear his account, it is intriguing.
Hmm.
I guess what I'm trying to say is that we have here a species that we really don't have a handle on it yet. We don't... we can't begin to fathom all of its abilities and talents, but in my opinion, they're incredible. I've here into my 23rd year, and it took all of that time to develop the evidence that I've gotten so far, plus seeing one. And I must tell you, when I had my sighting in August of 1997, I did not go public with that. I did not find physical evidence. until October of 1998. That's where that one of those tracks, the track that you see in the photo there, came from.
Right. Okay, let me try this approach. If Bigfoot is a real physical being, intelligent, a leftover, a throwback, whatever we imagine it to be, a real physical being, then though we might not have found Bigfoot, shouldn't we be finding a Bigfoot residence,
well,
a Bigfoot lair? I don't know what you would call it, but
I did.
I beg your pardon?
I found what I believe to be down here. We call it bush cave or vegetal den, and I found one. Okay.
Okay.
And it's one I go in great detail in the book about that.
Go into some detail here, please. What did you find?
Well, basically, what it is an extremely remote area. In fact, I was tracking deer at the time, tracking deer to find panther tracks. And people know what I'm talking about. Deer is prey of the panther, so a lot of times you would track the prey to find the panther. In the process, I came on to a bush cave. It was a huge tree overhang, very dense. You had to get down on your knees to go into it. I thought in the beginning that it may have been a black bear lair or a female setting up to have cubs, that sort of thing. So I was very cautious when I went into this bush cave, vegetal den. I had to crawl in. Interesting enough, when I was on all fours, the tree overhangs, the branches, were roughly about 3 feet above me. Okay, so in I went, and when I went in there, I had a very good smell of the scent. People down here, again, call them skunk apes. So we're talking about basically the species smells like a skunk, but it looks like an ape. But I carry it much further than that. And what I smelled was a very thick, not skunky smell, but more sweat and like real wet leather and a very strong, like something that has been burnt. Okay?
Oh, my.
And in I went. And I have to tell you that it was, there were two impressions that if they were a lay-down site, a resting site, in the back part, and this thing was probably roughly about maybe 15 feet in diameter. So it wasn't a big one. And the only reason I went in there is because my eye caught this hole in the vegetation. There were two laydown sites, and if they were black bear laydown sites, that puts those bears enormous, okay? And you could even see the impressions on the dead leaves of where the creature had laid out its long arm, and it weighed down into the leaves like he had his head down on his arm. Okay, I measured one of the resting sites, the laydown sites,
and
it appeared to be somewhere in the area of 6.5 feet long. The reason that was, it wasn't 6.5 feet. It was more like 7 or over 7 feet long, but it appeared as though the knee, there was a knee indentation in the leaves itself, to where it looked like we'll assume it's Bigfoot had brought its knees up a little bit. Okay,
I've
and
got
the
you. So
weight of its leg,
the total length when measured out would be more like 7 feet.
Yeah, that you know, I allowed about a foot there because it looked like he had brought the leg. But there were two of those, which was interesting, and one was a little bit smaller than the other. So I know what you're thinking. Now we have a mating couple here. I don't know. What I did was, totally intrigued, there I was in the midst of, and this was in the 80s, there I was in the midst of another incident with the Bigfoot phenomena. So I staked the place out for 3 days. And nothing happened. No one came back. I continually went back there. And I'll tell you something interesting about it. Only one time did it look like something visited it again. And then after that, I found raccoon tracks going in it, possum tracks going in it,
but
that type of thing.
No Bigfoot.
So he left. And I'm wondering...
Again, the implication, the intelligence, he may have been just a step or two ahead of you in
yeah.
the intuitive category and found you before you found him.
That's
or them.
Or he, yeah, or they might have picked up my scent, you know, and this place is no good anymore. We have to move on because now somebody found us.
Let me tell you how good technology is. We now have the photographs on the website. So if people go to my website and scroll down to the name James McMullen in the guest area, they will find two photographs, one that says photo collage and the other says Bigfoot cast. Now, photo collage shows, in fact, a couple of pictures of panthers. James, are these panthers that you found in Florida?
Which ones are they? I'm trying to remember what I said.
Well, there's a picture of you in the center. There's a duck in the picture in the center. It looks like a duck.
I got you.
There's a panther in the upper left-hand corner and the bottom right-hand corner.
No, that's my baby. I raised a panther from baby to adulthood.
You're kidding.
No. And I named the panther. It was a female, Tracker.
How in the world... James, I have cats. I have three cats. And I can only imagine, in fact, I really can't imagine something 25 or 30 times the size of my cat or 100 times the size of my cat. Even in play, such an animal would rip your guts out without even thinking about it. How could you have that as a...
Well, Tracker was a one-man cat. And she adapted to my behavior early on as a cub. And you have to understand she was with me for over 16 years. I must also tell you that she did not live in my house.
Good.
Only one time when we had, actually two times. We had a big blow once down here, and I brought her into the house. And when Hurricane Andrew went through, I brought her into the house for obvious reasons. But she, for the most part, except when she was a cub, she lived outside in the Pineland Forest. A friend of mine had a nice setup out in the tree line, and we set her up out there in an enclosed area with
That's
a roof
incredible.
On it. And I would take her with me out into the swamp, and it was kind of a parallel. She was like my swamp teacher, teaching me about the behavior and the movements of the panther in the wilds.
Okay, well, this will give some idea
yeah.
to the people
yeah.
of the kind of person you are then. And then, of course, the second photograph... With this, how big was this foot?
I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah, your hand, you know, you've got your hand there toward the back of it, and my God, that foot must be, if I were going to guess, I'd say more than 2 feet long.
No, oddly enough, it must be the way the shot was taken. The general measurement is it's 14 inches long from toe to heel.
14.
And if you go up on to just underneath the toes, the widest part of the track, it goes across a little over 7 inches.
7 inches across.
So it's 14 inches by 17 inches. By the way, that's if we have time, we'll go into the track. That's a very deteriorated track. And I found 7 tracks. And that was the best one, and that's the one that I took the plaster cast of.
All right, and those photographs, folks, are on my website right now, The Magic of Technology. While I was doing the interview, I actually scanned them, sent them off to Keith. Boom, he got them, put them up on the website like that. So if you want to see this Bigfoot foot, cast of the foot, and you want to see the photo collage, go to my website at www.artbell.com. Scroll down to James McMullen. I guess this would be the first time they've been up on a website.
Absolutely.
All right. And you will see something people have not seen before. Well, we've got a lot of people that would like to talk to you, so let me bring a few on very quickly. First time caller line, you're on the air with James McMullen. Hi.
Good evening, Art.
Good evening.
Peter.
Peter, you're going to have to yell at us a little bit. Where are you?
Well, I'm in Yakima, Washington,
all
KIT.
Right. Oh, yes, sir.
Tell you what, I've got a couple of facts that you've kind of touched on, and I think maybe you don't know or at least would like to know.
All right.
Clark County, Washington, passed a law about, oh my gosh, it must have been at least 20 years ago, that it is illegal to shoot a Sasquatch and kill it.
I'll be there.
Yeah, Clark County, Washington. That's when you're leaving Portland, Oregon, you drive into Washington. That's the county you hit, Vancouver.
Well, there must
have been... Is it still on the books?
Yeah.
Yeah, there must have been some reason why they passed that law.
Well, at the time that I read when the law first went into effect, they were curious about Sasquatch, and only because I think their county extends up to the southern boundary of Mount St. Helens National Park, or National Volcanic Monument, as it's really called. And Ape Cave is not too far from their boundary, only about 5 miles.
Ape Cave.
Yeah, which is in Ape Canyon. And there had been some sightings there years past. And I think Clark County merely determined that since we don't know what this critter is, that we, and since it seems to be somewhat humanoid, you know, why would somebody want to shoot it? I mean, capture it maybe, but don't
yeah.
kill it. And they actually passed that law. And
they
that's still on the
okay.
books.
And it's still on the books.
Yeah.
All right. James?
Well, obviously, I think it should be revised. There is a grand opportunity, Pacific Northwest area, where you could introduce, since there is a law on the books now, that could introduce the possibility of putting at least an Endangered Species Act on it as well. It sounds to me like people are quite convinced that Sasquatch is out there.
Apparently. As you are well aware, there have been many, many sightings in the Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
But that would seem to say something. In other words, if there are sightings in the Northwest, which has one very distinctive kind of weather, very different from what you would have in the Everglades,
yeah.
that would seem to suggest that Bigfoot, like a human being, is capable of surviving in all sorts of environments, huh?
Very much so. And I also might add that the state of Florida's gathering of sightings is, in the United States, is the second location in the United States
most
as far as number of sightings go.
Huh.
And, of course, Pacific Northwest, and then it's Florida, and then it goes on down the list then.
Well, then here's an obvious question. What about the rest of the world? Would Bigfoot be indigenous just to North America, or are there reports from South America, the Australian continent, Europe, Africa? What about the rest of the world?
Yes, I've been following that as closely as I can, and there is a world map that I believe it's on a website. I brought it out on a website, and there was red dots literally all over the world. You know, I mean, in China, in mm-hmm. Russia, mm-hmm. you name it, there's red dots spotted all over the world. And going back to what you just said, here is an extremely adaptable species. They quite literally can adapt to a cold weather climate as well as subtropical and then down into South America of tropical.
Hmm.
It's incredible.
Actually, that would make it more adaptable than we are. We require support, as in air conditioning or heating or protection from the elements, to some greater degree than they obviously do. So that would make them more adaptable to climatic changes than we are.
Yes, yeah, very much so. Totally adapted to the wild environment. It baffles me all the time.
All right, James. We're going to try and lay into the phone lines heavily. Again, the photographs that I scanned while we were doing the interview, that's really fun, are on the website right now. Thank you very much, Keith Rowland. Just scroll down to the guest area, James McMullen's name, and you'll see photo collage and Bigfoot cast. And if you want to see one mama of a Bigfoot, wait till you see this sucker. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight, featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from May 11th, 1999. Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from May 11th, 1999.
You're listening to James McMullen, who has been a tracker all his life. James also was in Vietnam, in the Marine Corps, as a matter of fact, 1st Marine Division, General Walt's Amphibious Landing Force. Wounded in action, he received the Purple Heart. So this is a serious man embarking on a serious endeavor to find and prove the existence of Bigfoot, which he has seen. There are photographs on my website that you should see. You'll find it under the newest site editions area, and you'll also find it down near James McMullen's name. You'll find links to the cast of the foot that he made, and that sucker is big. That's on my website now at www.artbell.com. Go take a look and let me know what you think. Okay, back now to James McMullen, and we're going to lay heavily into the phone lines this hour. James, are you there?
Yes. Art, remind me to tell you about the Bigfoot Disappearing Act as I experienced back in the late 80s when we have a chance.
All right. Okay, let me take a couple of these calls, and we'll
Great.
Do that. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with James McMullen and Art Bell. Hi.
Hi, Art. It's Greg in El Cajon, California.
Hi, Greg.
Hi. James, nice to speak to you this evening.
Yeah.
I have two questions, if I may. The first, in your opinion, James, is Bigfoot a lost member of the human gene pool, or do you feel Bigfoot was present here on Earth before the dawn of man?
Wow. Well, again, I think it's impossible for us at this point to verify with physical evidence that hit in relation to the gene pool. We do need some really hardcore DNA sampling, and the best way to do that is with skin sample, blood sample, hair sample. To a point, it shows unknown species, but in talking with anthropologists, they would be much more satisfied if they had a fragment of skin, possibly blood. I mean, that's asking a whole lot.
Okay.
What was the other part of the question?
The last part of the question, the first question was if, in your opinion, that the Sasquatch had been here before the dawn of man.
Yeah. Now, that gets into the intriguing mythology, again, down here with the Seminole and the Miccosukee Indian, and they talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about how the animals were here before us, but more important, S.D. Jepjeki was here as well before human beings. And it's mythology, but it is so intriguing that you begin to wonder if there isn't something to that historically.
Well, okay. And my last question is just a very short question. I'll just jump off and listen afterwards. The Patterson film, in your opinion, authentic or hoax? Thank you, sir.
Yeah.
All right.
I tell you, sometimes when I see the Patterson film on a Monday, I'm, just internally intrigued on it. On Friday, if I look at it, I have questions on it. But I go a lot by what the scientists have done in relation to analyzing it. And it comes up, in my opinion, more authentic than hoax. And for someone to have hoaxed what the scientists have come up with in relation to analyzing the film, someone would have to be a genius, absolutely a genius, to have pulled it off.
Well, let me pin you on the wall here.
Sure.
Would you be more likely to believe that Bigfoot is a real physical artifact that doesn't come and go and disappear, or that Bigfoot is a paranormal event? And something I surely don't rule out. I wonder which way you, if you were pushed up against the wall, which would you grasp?
Well, I funny you should say that, because I had an experience, the closest, I guess, that I'm going to get with in relation to paranormal on just what you said there. I was coming back from a place called Dead Man's Slough during the rainy season, and I was roughly in a foot of water. And as I was walking along, I heard someone pounding on, like, a big log. And there wasn't anything arithmetic about it, but it sounded like someone had a big club and they were pounding on this log off in a sable palm hammock, which was roughly about not more than 50 yards away at the most. So as I was working my way over to the hammock to take a look at who was in there, thinking maybe somebody might be making a shack or something, it stopped. And I entered the hammock. I went up, and I found this huge oak tree that had fallen down and was half hollowed out, and there was a big, huge branch laying down next to it, and it appeared as though the tree itself, the log itself, had been beat upon to where the bark was falling off. At that point, I heard someone running away from the hammock in the opposite side. And out of curiosity, which gets me in a lot of trouble all the time, I chased after whoever it was. And as I came outside the tree line and around the hammock, I could still hear, I couldn't see, but I could still hear the individual running. And it was a big person. It was someone with big boots on, that sort of thing. And so I chased it, and I began to find in the sable palm fronds that had fallen down and the leaves and the mud blotches, and didn't stop to measure at that point, but there was a pretty wide stride in there. All of a sudden, and I could hear him running up ahead. All of a sudden, the running stopped, and I thought, well, the guy stopped. He's going to see who's chasing him. I very cautiously walked under this tree overhang and around into the open on a wet prairie, mm-hmm. and he was gone.
Gone. And I have to tell you, the tracks were gone, too. The tracks were gone, too. So is that what you were referring to when you said disappearing act? Yes. Yeah, okay. Well, that would imply something something supernatural. Well, obviously, you know, it was a bit unnerving, obviously, but I was baffled. And it wasn't that much of high ground that he had run up on, but what intrigued me more was that the sound of the running stopped. And when I got there, there was nobody there. Now, when I backtracked, I measured a couple of the strides of the blotches, and it was 54 inches. 54 inches between two of those tracks. That makes for a pretty big stride. And I tracked that area for at least another half hour and found absolutely nothing. You know, I'm as baffled as the next tracker and something like that. This is what I love about this kind of subject. You can't quite pin it down to the normal or the paranormal, and it might be either one or both. And I'm sure for somebody who's a real meat and potatoes kind of, you know, tracker like yourself, somebody who's really out there doing this thing every day or nearly every day, it's hard for you to accept a virtual disappearance. It's like talking about a ghost. Yeah. I can't tell you how many times I went back there to that same hammock, thinking that somebody was going to show up again and start beating on that. You know, that I can't imagine why whoever it was or what it was beating on the log with that huge branch. There was no rhythm to it. That's another thing that I've heard about Bigfoot, that it can be attracted or communicated with in some manner by beating on a log, by beating on a tree stump or whatever. Uh-huh. You know about that? Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a possibility. I'm thinking, wondering, this may sound very far-fetched, but what if, for the sake of discussion, this particular Bigfoot was banging on that log to communicate with another one, and I just happened to come sloshing along in a foot of water and scared him off, you know what I mean? Not exactly unheard of, since Native Americans beat on drums for communication, yes? Yeah. All right. East of the Rockies. It's intriguing. It's just terribly intriguing. East of the Rockies, if you're there, you're on the air with James McMullen and Art Bell. Hi.
How you doing, Art?
All right.
I'm Eric from Iowa, and I was wondering, now you said the climates and whatnot. Well, I heard something really scary. I haven't really seen it. But I was down in the backwoods, and I heard something like take off through the brush, and I do know what deer and whatnot sound like, you know. And this took very big steps, very long strides, and broke a lot of branches. And then it was just like silence. But, of course, I turned tail and ran the other direction.
That would have been my move, too.
The question I have for James is, what do you think of having, like, the Bigfoot or Yeti or whatnot, you know, in this area here, you know?
Iowa? Yeah, you have sightings in, several sightings. I believe it's in the southeastern. Is there a wilderness track down in the southeastern Iowa there?
I'm living on the Mississippi side along the bluffs. So.
Okay. Along the Mississippi towards, I can't think of the town right now, but let's just deal with your area there. Along the Mississippi in the southeastern part of Iowa, there is red dot sightings of Bigfoot in that area. So I'm not surprised to hear that you may have stumbled onto it. Was that during the daytime when you...
This was night, you know.
Is it night?
So, yeah, it was nighttime. And I've heard deer, like I said, and I've heard other things, but this just, you know, it scared the bejeebies out of me.
Yeah, that's much worse. Nighttime is much, much worse.
Yeah, you didn't go back there that night and check and for tracks?
Oh, no,
and...
no. Actually, we were going back to see, because my friend of mine seen a tall object moving through, okay? So
all
we
right.
go back. And we got flashlights.
Uh-huh.
And next thing we know, some goes running off through the woods. And, of course, you know, the first reaction I had was to turn around, tail, and run, you know.
Yeah.
I'm a pretty big guy myself. You know, I can make a lot of noise. But this thing had been much larger
yeah.
than me.
Yeah.
All right. James, another to-the-wall question for you.
Yeah.
If you were in the wilderness, in the woods, in the Everglades, wherever, and you saw a Bigfoot, I take it that you don't go in these areas without a gun, even though you don't use it. No doubt you have a gun, right?
No, I don't.
You
I have
don't have
a... I have never carried a pistol, a gun, grenade, machine gun, or anything of that nature.
Oh, really?
The Everglades.
Oh,
I have
really?
I have a Swiss hunting knife that I take with me.
A Swiss hunting knife.
No weapons whatsoever across the board, ever.
Well,
I take into the Everglades.
If you were out in the middle of nowhere and you ran into one of these things, like the one you saw, and I'm setting up a scenario here.
Yeah.
And it was coming toward you with obvious intent to do you some sort of harm.
Hmm.
What would Jim McMullen do?
Well, at that point, there's one thing. Well, obviously, you're not going to be able to run away from them. I have a theory here. Follow me on this. I've been in those areas that you talk about, and I seek out the remote areas that are left in the Everglades. And for 23 years, I've been doing that. And here's Bigfoot roaming in the tree line and has never once stepped out to grab me and take my head off for one reason or another. So my working theory is that he would not do that. Now watch, next Saturday night I'll go tracking and he'll walk up on me.
Well,
I tell you something interesting about that. I have a tremendous love for Mother Nature and I am very sincere about my efforts to help save it. And that is my attitude all the time, whether I'm in the swamp or not. Carrying that a step further is my hope that the food chain, the animals that live out there, understand that I'm not harming their critical habitats.
Uh-huh.
And I have a theory that maybe, just maybe, when I'm walking along those trails over the years, that there may well have been Bigfoot watching me, and I'm doing no harm, so he just moves on.
May well have been, but I've got to say, even with everything I said and the story I told you about the squirrel and everything else, if I was out in the wilderness, I can assure you I would have some sort of protection against an animal, a bear, whatever it would be, that might decide I was part of the food chain.
Yeah, I understand that.
So you got a lot of guts going out there with nothing but a camera.
Well, it's the way, again, I have to tell you that I have had bear come on to me. I have been in neck-deep water with alligators on the other side of logs. I have come out of the water line, look up, and there sits the rattlesnake. You know, there were many times there where you know, I could have quite easily bought the farm, and nothing happened, ever. And I'm not saying that it would never happen, but here I am 23 years down the trail and still cooking on all four burners with no problem.
Well, that's a good point. First-time caller line, you're on the air with James McMullen. Where are you, please?
In Vancouver, Canada.
Well, hi.
Hi, it's Terry here. I used to live up in the wilderness and on the coast here in Canada, Western Canada, and I've had two stories I want to tell you, and then the question will be obvious. One is I was in a tiny little town up just south of the Yukon border, And the people up there in those years were very non-metaphysical and somewhat fundamentalist Christian.
Sure.
And if you saw a Sasquatch up in those years, you wouldn't mention it. And I ran into one fellow, he was a prospector up there, who saw one, and he said it took him 5 years before he admitted seeing it. And he said what had happened is he was driving down the road in his pickup, and he said they've got the ability to put some kind of spell on you. They become so still that you don't notice. He says he drove by something, and up it's very, very peaceful up there, and people's minds get very peaceful. And I guess he had gotten into a very sort of meditative state of mind, and he realized that he had driven by something, and he stopped. He says, hold it, no, there's something going on here. And he stopped, and he backed up, and he could see in his rearview mirror that there was a Sasquatch, and he says it was absolutely still. And he said it could put some kind of hoodoo on you so that you didn't notice it. And he came up, he backed up beside it, and it remained absolutely still. And he looked at it for a while, and then it turned and walked away. That's one story I've got for you. The other story is I used to spend time in logging camps, and I used to hang out with this Indian fellow who had been raised in an Indian village, and he was an extremely peaceful type, too. And he told me that his grandfather and his grandfather's friends used to tell him about seeing Sasquatches in the bush. And he said that the grandparents talked about the very wide and slow strides that these huge creatures took.
Yes.
And I wonder if the word Sasquatch doesn't actually relate to this, to the length of their stride. And it's interesting to think, because this Indian fellow was an extremely peaceful person, one of the most peaceful I've ever met in my life.
All right, well, let's ask Jim about that. Jim, the word, from where is the word Sasquatch derived?
Sasquatch goes, again, back to Native American. I've gotten two general definitions of Sasquatch. One, interesting enough, the Seminole, or Choctaw Seminole down here, call him Sasquatch as well as the Native Americans, you know, throughout North America. And I'm still getting, there's two. There's tall, hairy man, and the other one is wise, wild man. So I'm wondering if Native American out in, you know, Pacific Northwest Canada, if that isn't pretty close to what they're, what they define it as well. Yeah. And interesting, you know, he's talking about the, I have to tell you, and this is a one-liner, but there are times, there have been times in the past, and I'm sure there will be in the future, where I would be tracking, let's say on high ground, high dry ground, sandy soil, and have a definite purpose and going from A to B, and my goal is to do 3 miles, walking down the backcountry through pine, suddenly, for no apparent reason, I'm turning in another direction and end up circling back to where I began. And I'm wondering, and then having tracked that area maybe 2 or 3 days later, I do the same area going in the same direction and do the complete mile and a half or the 3 miles with no, you know, with no reason to take a left or take a right. I'm just wondering with the gentleman, with his stories, if there might be something to that. That looking for Bigfoot, tracking Bigfoot, all of a sudden he doesn't want me to go into a particular area, so he puts me off, and again, we're talking theory, but he puts me off in another direction.
So, to go back to my original question, if a Bigfoot was moving toward you with obvious intent to do harm, your reaction would be to simply stand your ground and say, good Bigfoot, good Bigfoot. I mean, you said you wouldn't run, so what other alternatives are there?
Well, here's my problem. I can't think of anything in the food chain, in the Everglades itself, any animal, poisonous or not, reptile, name it, that I have any fear of. However,
well, there are
there are
man-killing bears, aren't there?
Well, we have black bear down here. And
Hold on, Jim. We'll pick up on this when we get back from the break. I believe there are, or maybe that's just in the movies. We'll find out.
You're listening to Art Bell Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from May 11th, 1999.
myself. What a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight, featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from May 11th, 1999.
James McMullen. Jim McMullen, if you will, is my guest. We're talking about Bigfoot. Could it be?
I see friends shaking hands, saying how they do.
You bet it could be. I'll ever know too. Good morning, everybody. Bigfoot is the subject. We'll get right back to it. All right. Back now to James McMullen. And James, I want to ask you this. I may watch too many movies. I love movies. And Anthony Hopkins is probably one of my favorite actors, maybe even my favorite actor. I really like Anthony Hopkins. He did a movie called The Edge. You see that?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In that, there was a man killing bear. It does, I believe, occasionally occur that a bear finds man to be an appropriate part of the food chain.
Yeah.
Now, so that is true?
Yes, yes, absolutely, even with black bear down here.
So it's possible you could run into something that would regard you as dinner.
Yes, I must confess that twice in 23 years I was approached by black bear. Neither time I didn't feel that I was in danger, except one time this particular bear put me into a water line so I could put distance between us, and oddly enough the bear did not come into the water. The other time that a bear came onto me, I don't think the bear even saw me because I was bent over looking at a thorn spider inside of a wax myrtle bush, and he was coming from my right in high grass. We both looked at each other, saw that we were definitely in the right, and we quite literally we both ran in the opposite direction.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what is the if you were to give somebody advice, if they were to come upon a bear and you're staring at each other for that second, both no doubt in some form of terror, is it best to be still or run?
Well, I tell you what, in my opinion, I would run to the nearest tree I could climb and get up as high as I can. I know that people have read these articles in some of the magazines about if a bear approaches you, lay down and act like you're dead. And I ain't about to do that with black bear and surely not a grizzly or brown. There are too many incidents where bears have got in close to humans and did a real job on them. I'll take my chances running and climbing that tree or jumping into a river.
I must tell you, though, Art, yes.
One of the chapters in my Bigfoot book, we were talking about coming eye-to-eye with Bigfoot. Well, one of the chapters that I'm dealing with in the book is called Dark Wild Eyes. And I did, in a sense, come eye-to-eye with what I believe to be a Bigfoot. The problem is that it was roughly about 70 yards away from one tree line across the prairie to the other tree line.
Right.
And I was coming out of the tree line, but any time that I was coming out of a tree line, I always stopped, like, right on the edge of the tree line and do a scan of roughly 180 degrees back and forth to see if anything's crossing the prairie or there might be a panther on the other side or maybe have a sighting of a deer feeding, something like that. And I kept going past this tree line. And I thought that I could see two eyes inside of the trees and inside of some cell phone looking back at me. And they riveted me to the spot. And I just, it was like we were staring at each other. And I wasn't even sure what I was staring at, because all I saw was shadow and two dark, wild eyes staring back at me.
I wouldn't do that, Jim. All right, we've got a lot of people here. First time caller line, you're on the air with Jim McMullen. Hi. Where are you, please?
This is Dutch. I'm in Chicago, Illinois.
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'm an over-the-road truck driver. I've been listening to you for quite a long time. I've got to comment on the whole Sasquatch thing.
Sure.
I've been following the story for a long time, the TV, movies, the books. I've read a lot of books on the subject. Now, obviously, these things are very intelligent. I mean, even with the encroachment of a human civilization, they've remained hidden. We've never really had any real contact with them or anything. We have a few sightings, whatever. And so they avoid us for all this time. Why don't we just leave them alone? I mean, if they wanted to contact us, we would have already. I mean, they've probably observed us for all these centuries, and they see the nature of mankind. We kill everything, we destroy everything we get a hold of.
Well, the caller makes a very, very good point, Jim. If they are that intelligent, then maybe they have made, with regard to us, the intelligent decision?
Yeah. And I happen to agree with the with that person very much. It's one thing to track, the thrill of tracking an unknown species and developing physical evidence to prove that he exists, but it doesn't mean that we should go out there and harm his critical habitat or, in fact, try to capture him. And then the bottom line is what the caller said, leave him alone. They have never, ever done us any harm, although Seminole have a couple of stories in relation to women disappearing. But beyond that, there's never been any killings by Bigfoot of human beings, at least down here, and I don't know.
Now, you mean there are stories that they have carried off our women?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That is a very strong, and if you're talking with Seminole and they bring this up and, you know, you even so much as crack a smile on that smile, they're very offended. And those stories come way back when the Seminole, the original tribes that make up the Seminole came down here. And they would, not a lot, but occasionally one of their women would be at night pulled out of the village, and the next morning they would find these huge tracks leading off into the swamp and water, and the woman was never heard of again.
Well, you know, Jim, I say this seriously, there are a lot of missing people, and a lot of them are women, you know, cases that are simply never solved.
Yeah, wow.
To something to you think about it, I suppose. Wildcard line, you're on the air with James McMullen. Hello.
Hi, Art. This is Andy from Largo, Florida.
Hi, Andy.
How are you?
Fine.
Good. I got a good documentary on Bigfoot, and in it, Dr. Grover Krantz, an archaeologist, talks about from the early 80s, 82 to 85, Washington had a problem with organized posses approaching the backwoods looking to hunt a Bigfoot,
right,
which led to a law in Skamania County saying anyone caught shooting a Bigfoot would be fined $10,000 and put in jail. Personally, I don't think shooting one would be justified in any way.
You know something that occurred to me? There are a lot of people said to be faking Bigfoot things, right?
Yep.
Well, if you were to put on a big old Bigfoot outfit and go tromping through the woods trying to freak somebody out, wouldn't the odds be real likely that you'd get shot?
Well, yes, exactly. They talk about that in the film. And also, Grover Krantz talks about, for example, the Patterson film. He studied this and says, in his opinion, there's no way it could have been faked, because looking at it, if you were to put a man in an ape suit, you'd have to break his arms and put a new hinge on the lower socket where it meets the elbow.
Yeah.
And there's just too much about it, scientifically proving it. They still consider it forbidden archaeology, though, but, you know, it's people like your guest that get this stuff out, and, you know, good job.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much. What about that with regard to the Patterson film? Were there movements that would have been impossible for a human being to make in that film?
Yeah, absolutely verified. Grover Krantz is one of the scientists that have studied that film, and absolutely verified of what your caller is talking about. And so it makes for, again, as I talked about earlier, this is what leads me to believe that Patterson did stumble onto one and had an opportunity to get her on film. And carries a step further, when you go through that scientific study and you read, when they really break it down, the stride, the swinging of the arms, the turning of the head with the shoulders, it's impossible for a human being to do that, but it is very likely that the Patterson film, that makes the Patterson film even more authentic. And also, I'm very much aware of that law out there. That was one of the things that I researched to begin with, to see if there were any laws on the books protecting Sasquatch.
Well, surely they would not make a law without some serious reason for making
yeah.
it. I mean, obviously somebody had some very, very serious encounter to get something like that through. Otherwise, they'd be laughed out of the chambers that would be voting that law in. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with James McMullen. Hi.
Howdy. This is Jim calling from a truck stop in Atlanta.
Oh, hi, Jim.
Howdy.
Thank you for taking all that trouble.
And I was wanting to ask your guest if he would speculate for just a moment if he believes that the Bigfoot is related to the great apes or if it represents a member of possibly Neanderthal.
I, to be honest with you, I can't comment on the Neanderthal end of it. But I can tell you that, generally speaking, I've talked to six anthropologists that have studied the Bigfoot phenomena, and all of them came up with this possibility that it may be an unknown species that very likely is primate. I mean, this is how they get a handle on it. But again, I care to step further and say that that's too short of an answer. There's got to be a lot more to it.
All right.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. Here's an interesting bit of email. I don't know if I believe it or not, but it says, I'm not sure if it's really well known or not, but here in Washington State on our mountain highways, we actually have Sasquatch crossing signs.
Yeah.
They're few and far between, but they do exist here. I've seen one, but it's been a while. Is that true?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I've gotten, I don't have pictures of them, but I've gotten two calls from people on sightings that they mentioned that. That there are watch out for Sasquatch going across the road signs.
All right. If somebody would be kind enough to send me a photograph of one
yeah.
of those, I'd really love to have it. All right. Wow. Let's continue. West of the Rockies?
On the sign itself, there is a black figure of a Bigfoot in stride. That would help.
I've got to see one of those. All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with James McMullen and Art Bell. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call.
Art. Sure, sure.
And, Jim, I always want to take an opportunity to thank those who've served our country.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yeah. In listening to what you've had to say, it sounds as though over a 21 period in your search for the Florida panther and your research on that, that you had developed an interest in the Bigfoot.
Yes.
And during the time when you had your first sighting, when you were in your van and trying to park and everything, if I remember correctly, you said that before you went out, that you had actually gone out to debunk that story,
yeah.
that there had been sightings. And that you'd gone out there to debunk the story, so I'm wondering if if you had the interest, why would you want to?
Oh, why would I try and discount it?
Right.
Well, there's a reason for that, because in the area where the initial sightings were taking place, this is the sighting flaps of August 1997, the summer of 1997. Actually, the 2 weeks of July and then into the month of August and a little bit of September, there were a lot of stories flying back and forth that one of the reasons why there was these sudden reports of Skunk Ape Bigfoot in that area was to prepare the people in Everglades City and Ochoapi and what have you, that area were preparing publicity set up to attract interest and tourists coming down in the fall. And being aware of all the physical evidence that I had gathered over the years, roughly last, 21 years at that point, the curiosity got the better part of me because there were two reporters down there doing the same thing and trying to discount all the sightings and make it kind of a joke. And I was not interested in discounting it to make it a joke. I was going to discount it if there was not physical evidence to back up the sightings. And there were some really intriguing sightings, and there was also a photograph that the chief, the fire chief down there took of something in the tree line that he saw. And I talked to those people, and they were very sincere with their efforts and all like that. And I was having a hard time discounting it. One of my approaches sometimes in situations like that, when you have sightings, is go in rather than being objective, discount it. And when you can't discount it, then you've got physical evidence that's going to come up to prove that, in fact, it existed. With me, I had a sighting of one. So that wiped out any possibility in the future of ever discounting Bigfoot in that particular area.
James,
I would have a trouble discounting anything, any sighting on Bigfoot now.
James, okay, let's talk about one. On the newly revived Unsolved Mysteries, first or second episode, somebody writes, there was indeed a Bigfoot sighting that they showed on tape in Florida, somewhere in the Deep South, anyway.
Yeah.
What do you make of that one?
Are you referring to the photographs?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, okay. I saw 25 of the 27 photos that a guy down there by the name of Dave Shealy took. And, in fact, he called me up the next day after he had taken the pictures and wanted me to come out and take a look at them. And he had them in negatives, and some of them were also in print. And that is, it shows, they're photos, it's not video, or any videotape or anything, but there is a series of what I call a series of a behavioral series working there when you line them all up from right to left. And they're very intriguing. There's two photos in there that, just absolutely fantastic. One of them actually shows the back with the arms, stretched out a little bit. And he's coming up out of the water a little bit, and you can actually see the muscles twitching up in the back of the shoulders. Now, the people in the area here are quick to discount those photos. I have taken two of them, negative and prints, to two photographers and one photo analyst. And they could not find anything to indicate that there was a creature superimposed onto the negatives, or trying to hoax it, that sort of thing. They couldn't find anything wrong with it. One photographer had a problem with the height of the creature that you see in the photo. But for the most part right now, and I don't know if Mr. Shealy has taken these to be analyzed by others in the Bigfoot circle. At least at this point, I don't know. It's pretty hard to discount these. Now, I have visited four times now and tracked directly in the area where Dave Shealy had taken those photos. And I was out there 3 days after he took the photos and tracked heavily all through there. But the problem was there's a water line there at that point, and there were no tracks at all whatsoever. So those photos have been offered by Dave Shealy to the Bigfoot community as very strong circumstantial evidence of Bigfoot in the Everglades.
Incredible. All right.
Yeah.
First-time caller line, you're on the air with James McMullen. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Kevin.
Where are you, Kevin?
I'm in St. Louis.
Okay. Do you have a question?
I'm in Big 50.
Yes, sir.
And I was gas fishing one time, like 2 years ago, down on the Missouri River, and I started hearing the brush start breaking,
right.
Something getting closer and closer.
Right.
And I don't know, I thought it was people at first, but just kept getting closer and louder, and it was too dark to be people. And then it just came walking, and it stopped right up behind me. I didn't know what it was at that point. And I was shining my flashlight all over. It was pretty dark. And then it started hitting the tree behind me.
Hitting the tree?
It started hitting the tree real hard.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, oh, wow. And I was panicking. I think I might even screamed at it or something. and then it hit it again, and it hit it again, and a tree started coming over.
Oh.
And it started falling on me, almost.
Uh-huh.
About, I would say, 3 feet from falling on me, the tip of the top of the tree.
Holy smokes.
Yeah. So I wasn't too worried about fishing then.
Well, what did you do?
Yeah.
What happened?
Excuse me?
What did you do?
I just froze and shined the flashlight on it. I was like, it was a fishing pole and a flashlight.
And so you saw
it. I was wishing I had a gun at that point.
Did you see it clearly?
Oh, I couldn't see what it was. It just kept shining and looking. Could not tell.
Boy.
It was too thick. And it's just a small little strip of woods.
I bet that's something you'll never forget, huh?
Oh, no.
All right. Thank you very much for relating all of that. Well, what a great pleasure it has been to have you on the air with us this night, Jim. Thank you very much. And when you do, I trust, obviously have a computer.
Yes, I do.
You've got to make it up to my website and see this Sasquatch Road sign.
I will.
I would not have believed it if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes, but by God, we've got a picture of it up on the website. Jim, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me, Art.
Good night, my friend. All right, Jim McMullen. That's it for tonight, folks. Tomorrow night, we've got another good one for you. You, too. Take a look at that road sign. Unbelievable. At www.artbell.com from the high desert. Good night.